Hi, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with the Arizona Daily Sun for Thursday, August 7th, 2025. I'm Flagstaff volunteer reader Lisa Cantergany, and today our front page articles include Canyon Fire Sets Back Businesses, High Court Ruling Sides with Residents of Page, and New Business Busts Out the Board Games. And we will get started with the first article, which is full titled, Impacts of Dragon Bravo Fire Are Daunting Even Before the Flames Are Out. And this was written by Sam McLaughlin, Sun staff reporter. It's been a month now since a lightning strike at the Grand Canyon's North Rim started a fire that would eventually grow into the largest active wildfire in the United States and the seventh largest fire in Arizona's recorded history. The Dragon Bravo Fire, mapped on Wednesday morning, at 130,520 acres, has roared across most of the containment lines firefighters have tried to throw in its path, and it continues to grow, though at a reduced rate this week, as it advances into more sparsely vegetated terrain. The consequent closure of the North Rim for the remainder of the 2025 season is a major blow to the economy of northern Coconino County. Businesses small and large are struggling with the abrupt loss of revenue across the region and the uncertainty of the near future. Crocky Meshkin started working at the Grand Canyon in 2016. After years as a tour guide, he started his own business in 2023, offering shuttle services to and from the North Rim for rim-to-rim hikers. In July 2024, he quit his day job to run that business full-time. Meshkin thought he'd found a solid plan for the next five or so years, I guess. He was earning decent money, he said, and enjoying the schedule flexibility. He was away on a 4th of July vacation to California with his girlfriend when he first heard about a lightning strike on the North Rim. He assumed the National Park Service, NPS, had the situation under control. But when he started receiving emergency alerts on July 12th, first an evacuation notice for the White Sage Fire, then one for the Dragon Bravo Fire, he began to realize things might be more serious. On the morning of July 13th, Meshkin dialed into a call with park employees, community members, and the park's superintendent. Little did I know, on the call, they're going to announce, we've lost the lodge, we've lost the visitor center, we've lost most of the cabins, he recalled. His first reaction, he said, was disbelief. But then the weight of the loss began to sink in. We lost the lodge? That means we lost everything inside that lodge, Meshkin said. There's Navajo rugs in that lodge. There's a Hopi Kachina costume in the one corner. There's so much history, let alone the structure, that would have been lost. The NPS has not yet released detailed information about what materials were evacuated from Grand Canyon Lodge ahead of the fire. In the following days, Meshkin said, he spent time with friends, talking through their shared anger and pain. He experienced a combination of grief, over the fire's impacts on a place he held so closely and gratitude for the time he'd been able to spend there. The memories of his first rim-to-rim hike in 2017, when he finished at the North Rim, stood out in his mind. I loved doing the south to north because you felt like you came into this fairyland with a giant forest, and there's this castle-like lodge that's made out of stone and giant timber, Meshkin said. You just felt like you walked back in time or through some portal to some magical land. 3 weeks after the fire's eruption, Meshkin is grappling with the economic reality of the North Rim's closure. I've run through the emotions. I'm devastated about the loss of the historic structures. My heart is broken about the loss of those forests, the effects it's going to have on the ecosystem. Probably thousands of animals that have died and weren't able to escape the fire, he said. And now I'm shifting to my future. How am I going to survive and make money the rest of the year? I'd built my life around this business at that point. He estimated that he would lose about $20,000 in anticipated revenue from the 2025 season. As the only one-person business operating on the North Rim, and a new business as well, he had no cushion or safety net to weather that sudden change of fortune. He isn't sure what the future will hold or whether he'll be able to continue running his company. For the moment, he shifted to chronicling the fire through his social media channels, deliberately making himself a witness to help process and accept what's happening. Meshkin is looking ahead to some documentary filmmaking opportunities, but he isn't sure how to fund those projects without the income from his hiker shuttle business. He's hopeful social media can generate some new opportunities or connections to make that work possible. And although he's not very optimistic about the possibility of economic relief, Meshkin said it would be a boon if something comes through that could be life-changing for me. Ripple effects. Coconino County Supervisor Lena Fowler, whose district includes the area of both the White Sage and Dragon Bravo fires, said the county is working on gathering data to apply for relief from the Small Business Administration. If the county can demonstrate economic losses from the fires, Fowler said, business owners may eventually be able to apply for low-interest loans with a 12-month grace period. But she acknowledged the uncertainty of that process and the impacts that the fires are already having on the region. We know the North Rim is really the economic driver, Fowler said. You know, you ask any of the businesses what their season is, and it's pretty much in line with the North Rim opening on May 15th and closing on October 15th. It's the economic driver in that whole region. The fires are likely to create all kinds of ripple effects, Fowler said. Until a more thorough evaluation of the damage is done, no one is sure how the area's hiking trails might be affected, she said, or what the impact on hunting season could be, or the consequences for local ranching operations. In the short term, smoke has been a major problem. For residents of the region, smoke from the Dragon Bravo fire has created unhealthy air conditions. And for businesses, The smoke has discouraged visitors from staying. It's really amazing just to see the thickness and the heaviness of the smoke when you drive through it, Fowler said. Cancellations of package tours, which included the North Rim, are affecting hotels and tour companies. Confusion about public access along Highway 89A impacted businesses around Marble Canyon and Lee's Ferry, according to Fowler, as well as Navajo vendors in the region who typically do business along the highway. Prior to the fire, Fowler said, Coconino County leaders had been talking with NPS about what infrastructural upgrades would be necessary to extend the North Rim's operating season. One small silver lining, she said, was that the rebuilding of the North Rim might present an opportunity to incorporate some of those changes, though it's too soon to say for sure. It just has to be assessed to see what the damage is, so we can see how, as a region, we start planning, Fowler said. In the meantime, she's trying to tell the world that we're still open. Once the fire is out, it's a great place to go fishing, great place to go hiking. There's really great businesses to visit. It's a great time to go on the lake, Fowler said. Fire managers speak in Fredonia. At a public meeting hosted in a school gymnasium in Fredonia on the evening of Tuesday, August 5th, Incident Commander Trainee Leif Evans discussed the response to the Dragon Bravo fire. He'd been fighting fires in Arizona and New Mexico for 34 years, he said, and the receptivity of vegetation to fire on the Dragon Bravo was the worst he'd ever seen. We had a couple of days where we had 30,000 acre runs, and that just doesn't happen, Evans said. When fire behavior is that extreme, he added, there's little the team can do besides let it buck, pull crews back for safety, and then pick up the pieces when the fire growth slows. Eric Smith, the NPS representative on the incident management team, said managers are using every single resource that is available to us to suppress this fire. And in seeming contrast to Grand Canyon National Park's earliest public statements about the Dragon Bravo fire, that the response has been full suppression since the beginning. The devastation this fire has caused, the damages, the area closure it's demanding, is a heavy loss to your economic driver of tourism, Smith said, acknowledging the fire's ongoing impacts. Scott Rogers, representing the Kaibab National Forest, said, I just want to be transparent with you all. This is going to be a long-term event from a recovery standpoint. Areas of the forest north of Highway 89A that were closed because of the White Sage fire will reopen on Friday, August 8th, Rogers said, but areas south of the highway will remain closed. We understand the upcoming hunting season and the importance of hunting tourism for this community, he added. Agency personnel declined to answer questions about NPS's initial management of the fire between July 4th and July 12th, stating that a report would be forthcoming once the fire was contained. Frustration in the room was evident. One attendee shouted, "You're not listening to us." That attendee complained that incorrect policies were responsible for the fires of recent years, including the Warm, Mangum, and Kane fires. "I'm sorry, ma'am, I wasn't here then," Doug Ruppel of the U.S. Forest Service replied. Another attendee questioned whether firefighters had pursued full suppression since the beginning, as Smith stated, or whether the initial lightning strike ignition had been allowed to burn within a perimeter. Press releases from the park on July 10th said the fire was being managed for resource objectives using a confine and contain strategy, which allows for the natural role of fire on the landscape. "The language they use is confusing," Smith responded. "Confine and contain is a suppression strategy. It's just how big did they build the box, and the box didn't hold." That answer did not seem to satisfy the meeting's attendees. "The decisions made in the first days of the fire are likely to come under extreme scrutiny, given NPS's sometimes inconsistent explanations, the fire's impact on historic structures, and the escalating consequences for the regional economy. Arizona's governor and senators have already called for an independent investigation." Nicole Branton from the Kaibab National Forest said the incident management team would continue to engage with nearby communities. "This isn't the end of the conversation. This is the beginning," Branton said. "We're going to be with you, and we're going to give you the transparency you all deserve." Another public meeting was scheduled for Wednesday evening in Page. And that article was titled, "Impacts of Dragon Bravo Fire Are Daunting, Even Before the Flames Are Out." And this was written by Sam McLaughlin, Sun Staff Reporter. Our second front page article today is titled, "High Court Ruling Sides with Residents of Page." And this is written by Bob Christie, Capital Media Services. A small town fight over a plan to overhaul a downtown area that made its way to the Arizona Supreme Court has led to a new ruling, making it much easier for residents across the state to block locally approved projects at the ballot box. The ruling, issued last week, says residents of Arizona's cities, towns, and counties have the absolute right to propose their own laws, even if elected officials have already decided on a redevelopment plan and told one of their government departments to implement it. The decision could lead to local governments across Arizona having their decisions on roadway widenings, redesigns, and other projects vetoed by voters at the ballot box. In this case, some residents in Page organized to oppose a plan approved by the city council to remake a 1.4-mile section of downtown to boost business activity. The Downtown Page Streetscape Project involved removing two of the four travel lanes on Lake Powell Boulevard through the city's business district, adding parking and wider sidewalks as a place to draw tourists and locals for dining and events. A center turn lane would remain. The city rejected a ballot measure proposed by local citizens that would block the road widening, saying it was administrative and not subject to the initiative process in the Arizona Constitution. A trial court judge and the Arizona Court of Appeals, in an opinion written by Justice Maria Elena Cruz before she joined the High Court in January, sided with the city. But the Supreme Court overturned those rulings, saying the initiative was legislative in nature and that the power of citizens to propose their own laws applied. Cruz recused herself and did not participate in the new decision. The foundational principle that informs this case is that the people's power to make laws is co-equal to their elected representatives' authority to create legislation, Justice Clint Bolick wrote for the unanimous court decision, unanimous Supreme Court. He said the initiative was legislative and backers had the right to propose it. Bolick wrote for the unanimous Supreme Court, the initiative expressly creates public policy. Preserving Lake Powell Boulevard as it existed on October 1st, 2023, and the means of accomplishing that policy, preventing the use of public funds to narrow the specified portion of the road. The fact that this reflects a change in public policy does not alter its legislative character. The High Court ordered the initiative be put before voters, but did not set an election date. That decision concerns Nancy Davidson, general counsel for the League of Arizona Cities and Towns, who said that at any given time, there are hundreds of roadway projects underway across the state, many of them involving multiple cities and requiring coordination between planners, traffic analysts, utilities, contractors, and more. She said the court decision classifying decisions about them legislative rather than administrative, as they always have been, appears to make them vulnerable to challenges. Are we opening it up? And I think we are, where we are allowing street projects to be basically second guessed by the electorate every single time, Davidson said. It could really wreak havoc on any type of infrastructure planning, especially now that we're going through so much growth. The plan was developed over nearly 8 years, and little opposition developed until the new group emerged after the city council had approved the project, said Bill Dyack, who served as mayor for 14 years before deciding not to seek re-election last year. It was prompted in part by the 2019 shutdown of the coal-fired Navajo Generating Station near Page and the Kayenta Mine that supplied it with coal, said Dyack, an 80-year-old retired power plant employee. More than 500 paying jobs at the power plant alone were eliminated. The loss of the major regional employers led the council to refocus on tourism and kick-started the streetscape project, Dyack said. The city was awarded a $5 million federal grant last year to pay for the makeover and set aside more than $5 million in city funds as well. You know, we used to have an industrial environment, high-paying jobs, and fully pensioned, Dyack said. We had a coal mine and a power plant. In 2019, all of that changed. We lost all of those high-paying jobs and everything, and we switched over to where our economy is now tourism. Since then, the small town political fight led to major changes in the council's makeup, hard feelings on both sides, and fears by Dyack that the damage will be felt for years. Deborah Roundtree, who with her veterinarian husband ran an animal hospital in town and organized the Page Action Committee to fight the streetscape project, agreed that hard feelings prevail from the battle she led. She's still angry at what she said were lies and deceit by the council and backers of the plan. And she said she's been harassed and intimidated. I've had my home security challenged. I can't tell you the level of what individuals did to try to keep the citizens from being allowed to vote, Roundtree said. I mean, that's the funny thing about this, right? Citizens have to vote, and they might vote in favor of it. We don't know. She complained about an anonymous letter that circulated, including among the council, criticizing her. And she said it spoke of rumors she can't prove, that there were people poised to cash in on the redevelopment plan. I have no idea why our past council believed that reducing Lake Powell Boulevard down to two lanes would cause us to have an economic increase, she said. Although she's opposed to the cost, her main complaint is that the plan would eliminate traffic lanes, saying it could lead to gridlock through town, as RVs, pickups hauling boats to the lake, and tourist buses try to navigate the tighter street. Dyack, a resident since 1980, said Roundtree has no one but herself to blame, and said she ginned up unfounded allegations against the council. She stirred the pot, and in order to do that, she had to discredit council, Dyack said. So wherever she got an opportunity to do that, she did. And then when it came down to the nitty-gritty, she backed off of that. As with most small-town political fights, it's hard to weigh who is right or wrong. Dyack said that the Main Street makeover is badly needed. He said those tour buses, RVs, and boat-hauling trucks speed through town. There's little parking and few places for the tourists that are now the city's lifeblood to congregate and spend money. An estimated 3 million tourists visit Page each year, drawn by two major natural wonders, the Colorado River's Horseshoe Bend Overlook, just outside the city, and Antelope Canyon on the nearby Navajo Nation. Horseshoe Bend alone, which the city controls, brings in about $6 million in tourist revenue from parking alone and other fees. Dyack said money the city uses for improvements at the site and promotion. What is clear is that opponents of the plan have not only the court victory, but now have the power to decide themselves. That's because they ran for political office, and last November, Roundtree and the project opponents won seats on the Page City Council. Council voted last month to end the project, but it could be revived unless the initiative passes. But the victories come at a cost, Dyack believes. It's hard enough to get someone that wants to step up and help their community by running for public office, he said. I think it's going to make people think twice. Why do I want to get in that arena? because she made the previous counsel out to be crooks and liars and cheats and stuff. None of that could have been further from the truth, he said. And that article was titled High Court Ruling Sides with Residents of Page, and that was written by Bob Christie, Capital Media Services. And just a reminder, you're listening to the Arizona Daily Sun from the Flagstaff Studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds programming is directed to those who cannot use print materials due to a disability. Listen to our live streams and learn how you can support us at the website sunsounds.org. You can also hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Our third front page article today is called New Business Busts Out the Board Games. Good Game Cafe offers new playing experiences, large selections. And this is written by Cody Bashore, digital editor. With more than 800 board games lining the walls and filling the shelves of Good Game Cafe, there's no question just how ardent its owners are about sharing their passion with the rest of Flagstaff. Andrea Barantes and Bennett Cool even met through a friend's weekly board game night, paving the way for their shared hobby to turn into a business. And should you still be in need of more convincing of their commitment, ask the two how many board game cafes they have visited during their travels around the world. I think close to 50, Cool said, with Barantas elaborating on just how far and wide those cafes spanned. Wherever we travel, we've always liked to search. Even abroad, when we went to Amsterdam last year, we were checking the board games there, Barantes said. They also had a board game store, and down the street they had a place where you could actually play. We got a Dutch game. Of course, as Cool admitted, they still need to figure out how to translate the game's instructions. Spanning the West Coast to the East Coast, all the board game cafe visits along the way are what inspired the two to open up Good Game Cafe this past November. Taking inspiration from many of their stops and seeing that no two of the cafes followed an identical model, Barantes and Cool began to work on their vision. Of the dozens of ones they went to, all have their own style, their own flavor, and their own thing, Cool said. We got to cherry pick the parts we liked and said, okay, I think this is what will work well in Flagstaff for this space. We didn't even know until we got the space exactly how far we would lean into more of a bar that has board games versus a board game retail space that has rentals. Looking to offer to Flagstaff an alternative to the late-night bar scene, though the cafe does allow for BYOB after 4 p.m., the two landed on a location in Fort Valley Plaza Shopping Center, just north of downtown Flagstaff, offering an abundance of local influences. Barantes and Cool have set out to make an impact in the community in various ways. As the business offers single-speed coffee roasters for their patrons up late playing, Timberline ice cream sandwiches from the nearby Jojo Bob's, and other local options. Offering special events such as low sensory afternoons on the second Saturday of each month and a queer game night on the fourth Saturday of each month, with 50% of entry fees donated to 1 in 10 in support of LGBTQ plus youth. Good Game Cafe has sought to provide an inclusive space. "We would like to be a cornerstone for the community," Barantes said. "Just in general, we want people to have fun, and we want to include everybody. If there's any way we can make that easier for people to enjoy games, we will try and do that." That extends to offering a low-cost avenue into the world of board games that blow past the classics, such as Monopoly, Sorry, and Life. For anyone looking to try a game without having to spend hundreds of dollars up front to purchase it, Cool welcomes them in for a new experience. It's so exciting when you see all the tables just having a good time playing games. We're just helping people have fun, have a good time, and be out and about, Cool said. If they play a new game every day, it'll take them years to get through it, waiting their turn. Good Game Cafe's collection of games was built in part from Barantis and Cool's personal supply, which had begun to outgrow the space they have available. Another few hundred games came from Caleb Alexander's vault after the business came to an end, with the rest added to the list of offerings specifically for the new business. Though they are clearly board game aficionados, Barantes and Cool have not yet played all of their own options. If anyone asks for a recommendation, I can happily recommend games. I can probably teach about 200 of the games shooting from the hip, Cool said. But if you are throwing a dart, you're not hitting a game I know offhand how to teach. The good news is we're experts at learning games. Admittedly, the business has cut into their own time to play games, allowing Barantis and Cool the opportunity to experience a few new options as well while working to teach customers. In addition to their membership model, which allows customers to visit the cafe an unlimited number of times each month, daily entry fees can be paid at any time to utilize the space. Members also have the ability to rent games to bring home for a limited time. And the cafe can also order games from the publishers to be sold directly to customers looking to add to their own collection. For any game, we definitely have the hookup, so we'll have a better chance to get it, Cool said. To see the full list of Good Game Cafe's game library, the calendar of monthly events or pricing on memberships, visit goodgame.cafe. And that front page article was called "New Business Busts Out the Board Games. Good Game Cafe Offers New Playing Experiences, Large Selection," and it was written by Cody Bashore, digital editor. Now we're going to move along from the front page and read some local and Arizona news briefs. The first one, written by Daily Sun staff, is called "Interstate 17 Traffic Shift Beginning Thursday, August 7th, South of Flagstaff." And there's a map here. "As construction continues on the wildlife overpass south of Flagstaff, traffic on Interstate 17 will temporarily shift to one side of the highway, according to the Arizona
Department of Transportation, ADOT. The traffic shift will begin on Thursday, August 7th, as I-17 narrows to one lane in each direction near Willard Springs Road, about 12 miles south of Flagstaff. Crews will be finishing the barrier wall placement in addition to other work on Thursday to switch both directions of traffic to southbound I-17 for at least 2 weeks. The shift will allow crews to install steel girders and accomplish other work above northbound I-17 while avoiding the need for highway closures during construction of the wildlife overpass. Another traffic shift will be used in the coming weeks to allow for the same work to take place in southbound I-17. Drivers should allow extra travel time, especially during peak travel times on weekends and weekdays, while I-17 is narrowed north of the Munns Park area. ADOT is partnering with the Arizona Game and Fish Commission Department on the $15.8 million Wildlife Overpass Project. The project, funded through a federal grant, is an effort to improve wildlife habitat connections while reducing the risk of crashes involving animals, especially elk and deer. The project is scheduled for completion by fall of 2026, and that news brief was called Interstate 17 Traffic Shift, beginning on Thursday, August 7th, south of Flagstaff. Our next news brief is titled, Body Located Near Cheshire Neighborhood, Identified as Flagstaff Missing Woman, also by Daily Sun staff. The Flagstaff Police Department, FPD, announced Tuesday evening it had located the body of 60-year-old Flagstaff resident Errico Starley along a trail near the Cheshire neighborhood. Starley was originally reported missing by her husband on July 27th, when it was believed she left her residence early in the morning, leaving her cell phone and vehicle at home. Starley had been known to frequent the Flagstaff Urban Trail System in the Cheshire area. According to FPD's press release, police received an anonymous tip on Monday evening regarding the discovery of possible human remains along a trail near the neighborhood. Officers responded to the area, but were unable to locate any remains due to the limited visibility during nighttime hours. FPD investigators, along with personnel from Coconino County Search and Rescue, returned to the area on Tuesday morning to continue the search. After the body of a woman was located, the Coconino County Medical Examiner's Office responded to the scene and confirmed the body to be Starley. FPD added that there is no indication of foul play at this time, but the circumstances surrounding Starley's death remain an active investigation. FPD asked that anyone with information related to the case contact the department at 928-774-1414 or silent witness at 928-774-6111. And that news brief was called Body Located Near Cheshire, Identified as Missing Woman by the Daily Sun staff. Our next news brief is called Man Arrested After Shooting at Train in Flagstaff, again by Daily Sun staff. The Flagstaff Police Department arrested a man on Friday, August 1st, for allegedly firing a gun at a passing train. Travaz S. Poitier, was booked into the Coconino County Detention Facility on charges of disorderly conduct with a weapon, discharging a firearm within city limits, possession of a weapon by a prohibited person, and theft. The incident occurred near the 500 block of East Route 66, just east of the downtown area, at approximately 5:15 p.m. According to Sergeant Jerry Rintala, the department's public information officer, at least one witness saw Poitier shoot in the direction of a westbound BNSF train. No injuries were reported. Under Arizona law, disorderly conduct involving the use of a deadly weapon or dangerous instrument is a Class 6 felony. The negligent discharge of a firearm within the limits of a municipality is also a Class 6 felony. Possession of a firearm by a prohibited possessor, that is, someone who does not have the legal right to own a gun in Arizona, is a Class 4 felony. Theft may be variously charged as anything from a Class 1 misdemeanor all the way up to a Class 2 felony, depending on the value of the stolen property. Normally, theft of property worth less than $1,000 is considered a misdemeanor. But if the property in question is a firearm, it will be charged as a Class 6 felony. Poitier was held on a $50,000 cash or secured bond. As of Wednesday morning, he remained in the jail's custody. And that brief was called Man Arrested After Shooting at Train in Flagstaff. Next local news brief is called City to Host Celebration for Indigenous Code Talkers, also by Daily Sun Staff. The City of Flagstaff will celebrate Indigenous Code Talkers during an event scheduled from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday, August 11th, at the Market of Dreams, located at 2136 North 4th Street. Members of the public are welcome to attend, as the event features an official proclamation, an informational message from retired U.S. Air Force Chief Master Sergeant Eugenio Tallis, and special honoring songs by U.S. Army E6 Staff Sergeant Clark Tenakongva. Additionally, there will be a cultural share through dances and songs from a local Hopi dance group. A light breakfast and lunch will be served to attendees. This event is made possible through the collaboration of members of the City of Flagstaff's Indigenous Commission, local youth voices, businesses, nonprofit organizations, and other volunteers who have donated their time and resources. Members of more than 30 Indigenous nations from the United States participated as code talkers in both World War I and World War II. In 1982, President Ronald Reagan proclaimed August 14th as National Navajo Code Talkers Day. President Reagan also dedicated the day to honor all Native Americans who gave their talents and their lives so that others might live. This year marks the 83rd anniversary of more than 400 Navajo men recruited during World War II as code talkers. The men made up a group of U.S. Marines who developed an unbreakable code using their native language. In March 2021, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey signed legislation making National Navajo Code Talkers Day a legal state holiday every year, honoring the courage of the Code Talkers and their critical role in the Allied victory of World War II. For questions related to the Indigenous Code Talkers celebration, contact Rose Toey, City of Flagstaff's Indigenous Affairs Administrator, at rose.toey, that's spelled T-O-E-H-E, at flagstaffaz.gov. And that brief was called City to Host Celebration for Indigenous Code Talkers. Our next news brief is called Game and Fish Commission will meet in Flagstaff on Friday. The Arizona Game and Fish Commission will hold a public meeting in Flagstaff on Friday, August 8th, at Little America Hotel beginning at 8 a.m. The meeting agenda and information on how to view the meeting online or speak to the commission is available at azgfd.com/commagenda. Comments may be made in person at the meeting or remotely from one of the Game and Fish Department's regional offices, but not the Flagstaff office. The Game and Fish Commission establishes policy for the management, preservation, and harvest of wildlife in the state. The commission also sets rules and regulations for managing, conserving, and protecting wildlife and fisheries resources, as well as the use of watercraft and off-highway vehicles. The commission's 5 members are appointed by Arizona's governor and serve 5-year staggered terms. Members must all be from different counties, and no more than 3 may be affiliated with the same political party. The current commission chair is Marcia Petrie Sue of Scottsdale, originally appointed by former governor Doug Ducey in 2022 and named chair last month by Governor Katie Hobbs. And that brief was called Game and Fish Commission will meet in Flagstaff on Friday. And I think this is the last of the news briefs. It's titled USDA Seeks Public Comment on Plan That Would Shutter Some Forest Service Offices. And this is written by Daily Sun staff. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, announced on Friday, August 1st, that it is accepting public feedback on a proposed plan to reorganize its workforce and consolidate many of its offices. As part of that plan, the department intends to close the 9 regional offices of the U.S. Forest Service. It is not yet clear how those planned closures would affect the decision-making processes or local operations of Forest Service units like the Coconino National Forest. In a July 24th memorandum announcing the reorganization plan, Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins stated that continued layoffs, consolidation of offices, and relocation of USDA employees out of Washington, D.C. would achieve improved effectiveness and accountability, enhanced services, reduced bureaucracy, and cost savings for the American people. Taylor McKinnon, Southwest Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, wrote in an email that closing the Forest Service's regional offices would negatively affect the management of public lands. Scrapping the Forest Service's southwestern region will drain conservation capacity from Arizona
and New Mexico's already stressed national forests and biodiversity, McKinnon said. Our region's frequent fire forests and rich biodiversity need stronger boots-on-the-ground leadership, not its elimination by the Trump administration. Comments on the plan may be sent via email to reorganization@usda.gov and must be submitted before August 26th. Although the comment period was not announced until August 1st, the 30-day window apparently began with the release of the Secretary's memo on July 24th. And that news brief was called USDA Seeks Public Comment on Plan That Would Shutter Some Forest Service Offices. And that was written by Daily Sun staff. And it looks like that's the end of our news briefs today. And that's all the time we have for the Arizona Daily Sun. For Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff, I'm volunteer reader Lisa Cantor-Ganey. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a great rest of your day. Take care.